with a straight face. She looked at me, puzzled, and then she burst into hysterical gales of laughter. I wasn't sorry to see it happen. When I had told her about my confrontation with Arnie in the student parking lot that morning, those strain lines on her face had grown deeper and deeper, her lips whitening as they pressed together. "I know that it looks sort of ridiculous," I said now. "That's putting it mildly," she replied, still giggling and hiccuping. "But it'll do the job if anything will."
"Yes. Yes, I suppose it should. And it's not exactly unfitting, is it?"
I nodded. I had that thought.
"Well, let's get in," she said. "I'm cold."
She climbed up into the cab ahead of me, her nose wrinkling. "Ugh," she said. I smiled. "You get used to it." I handed her my crutches and climbed laboriously up behind the wheel. The pain in my left leg had subsided from a series of sharp clawings to a dull throb again. I had taken to Darvon back in the restaurant.
"Dennis, is your leg gonna be all right?"
"It'll have to be," I said, and slammed the door. Chapter 51. Christine. It was 11:30 or so when we pulled out of the Western Auto parking lot. The first spats of snow were coming down. I drove across town to the Sykes' house, shifting easily now as the Darvon took hold. The house was dark and locked. Mrs. Sykes may be at work, Jimmy may be off collecting his unemployment or something. Lee found a crumpled-up envelope in her handbag, scratched off her address, and wrote "Jimmy Sykes" across the front in her slanting, pretty hand. She put Jimmy's key ring into the envelope, folded the flap, and slipped it through the letter slot in the front door. While she did that, I let Petunia idle in neutral, resting my leg.
"What now?"
she asked, climbing back into the cab. "Another phone call," I said. Out near the intersection of JFK Drive and Crescent Avenue, I found a telephone booth. I got carefully out of the truck, holding on until Lee handed down my crutches. Then I made my way carefully through the thickening snow to the booth. Seen through the dirty phone booth glass and the swirling snow, Petunia looked like some strange pink dinosaur. I called Horlicks University and went through the switchboard to get Michael's office. Arnie had told me once that his dad was a real office drone, always brown bagging it at lunch and staying in. Now, as the phone was picked up on the second ring, I blessed him for it.
"Dennis, I tried to reach you at home. Your mom said..."
"Where's he going?" My stomach was cold. It wasn't until then, at that exact moment, that all of it began to seem completely real to me. And I began to think that this crazy confrontation was going to come off.
"How did you know he was going? You've got to tell me.
I don't have time for questions, and I couldn't answer them anyway. Where is he going?" Slowly, he said, "He and Regina are going to Penn State this afternoon, right after school. Arnie called her this morning and asked her if she'd go with him. He said..." He paused, thinking. "He said he felt as if he'd suddenly come to his senses. He said it just sort of hit him as he was going to school this morning, that if he didn't do something definite about college, it might slip away from him. He told her he'd decided Penn State was the best bet, and asked her if she'd like to go up with him and talk to the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and to some of the people in the history and philosophy departments." The booth was cold. My hands were starting to go numb. Lee was high up in Petunia's wheelhouse, watching me anxiously. "How well you arranged things, Arnie," I thought. Still the chess player. He was manipulating his mother, putting her on strings and making her dance. I felt some pity for her, but not as much as I might have felt. How many times had Regina herself been the manipulator, dancing others across her stage like so many Punch and Judy's? Now, while she was half distracted with fear and shame, LeBay had dangled in front of her eyes the one thing absolutely guaranteed to make her come running. The possibility that things might just be returning to normal.
"And did all that ring true to you?" I asked Michael.
"Of course not," he burst out. "It wouldn't have rung true to her if she was thinking straight. With college admissions what they are today, Penn State would enroll him in July if he had the money for tuition and the College Board scores. And Arnie has both. He talked as if this were the 50s instead of the 70s. When are they leaving?
She's going to meet him at the high school after period six. That's what she said when she called me. He's getting a dismissal slip.
That meant they would be leaving Libertyville in less than an hour and a half. So I asked the last question, even though I already knew the answer.
They're not taking Christine, are they?
No, they're going in the station wagon. She was delirious with joy, Dennis. Delirious. That business of getting her to go with him to Penn State, that was inspired. Wild horses wouldn't have kept Regina from a chance like that. Dennis, what's going on? Please.
Tomorrow, I said. That's a promise. Firm. Meantime, you've got to do something for me. It could be a matter of life and death for my family and for Lee Cabot's family. You...
Oh, my God, he said hoarsely. He spoke in the voice of a man for whom a great light has just dawned.
He's been gone every time. Except when that Welch boy was killed, and that time he was... Regina saw him asleep, and I'm sure she wasn't lying about that.
Dennis, who's driving that car? Who's using Christine to kill people when Arnie isn't here? I almost told him, but it was cold in the telephone booth, and my leg was starting to ache again, and that answer would have led to other questions, dozens of them, and even then the only final result might be a flat refusal to believe.
Michael, listen, I said, speaking with all the deliberateness I could summon. For one weird moment, I felt like Mr. Rogers on TV. A big car from the 1950s is coming to eat you up, boys and girls. Can you say Christine? I knew you could.
You've got to call my father and Lee's father. Have both families get together at Lee's house.
I was thinking of brick, good, solid brick.
I think maybe you ought to go too, Michael. All of you stay together until Lee and I get there or until I call. But you tell them for Lee and me. They're not to go outside after...
I calculated. If Arnie and Regina left the high school at 2, how long before his alibi would be cast iron watertight?
After 4 o'clock this afternoon. After 4, none of you go out on the street. Any street, under no circumstances.
Dennis...
I can't just...
You have to, I said.
You'll be able to convince my old man, and between the two of you, you should be able to convince Mr. and Mrs. Cabot. And stay away from Christine yourself, Michael.
They're leaving right from school, Michael said. He said the car would be all right in the school parking lot.
I could hear it in his voice again. His knowledge of the lie. After what had happened last fall, Arnie would no more leave Christine in a public parking lot than he would show up in calc class naked.
Uh-huh, I said. But if you happen to look out the window and see her in the driveway anyhow, stay clear, do you understand?
Yes, but call my father first. Promise me.
All right, I promise.
But Dennis,
thank you, Michael.
I hung up. My hands and feet were numb with the cold, but my forehead was slick with sweat. I pushed the door of the phone booth open with the tip of one crutch and worked my way back to Petunia.
What did he say? Lee asked. Did he promise?
Yes, I said. He promised. And my dad will see that they get together. I'm pretty sure of that. If Christine goes for anyone tonight, it'll have to be us.
All right, she said. Good.
I threw Petunia into gear and we rumbled away. The stage was set. As well as I could set it, anyway. And now there was really nothing to do but wait and see what would come. We drove across town to Darnell's garage through steady, light snow, and I pulled into the parking lot at just past 1 that afternoon. The long, rambling building with its corrugated steel sides was totally deserted, and Petunia's belly-high wheels cut through the deep, unplowed snow to stop in front of the main door. The signs bolted to that door were the same as they had been on that long-ago August evening when Arnie first drove Christine there. Save money. Your know-how, our tools. Garage space rented by the week, month, or year. And honk for entry. But the only one that really meant anything was the new one, leaning in the darkened office window. Closed. Until further notice. Sitting in one corner of the snowy front lot was an old crumpled Mustang, one of the real door suckers from the 60s. Now it sat silent and broody under a shroud of snow.
"It's creepy," Lee said in a low voice.
"Yeah, it sure is."
I gave her the keys I'd made at the Western Auto that morning. "One of these will do it." She took the keys, got out, and walked over to the door. I kept an eye in both rearview mirrors while she fumbled at the lock, but we didn't seem to be attracting any undue attention. I suppose there was a certain psychology involved in seeing such a big, conspicuous vehicle. It makes the idea of something clandestine or illegal harder to swallow. Lee suddenly tugged hard on the door, stood up, tugged again, and then came back to the truck.
"I got the key to turn, but I can't get the door up," she said. "I think it's frozen to the ground or something."
Great, I thought. Wonderful. None of this was going to come easily.
"Dennis, I'm sorry," she said, seeing it on my face.
"No, it's all right," I said. I opened the driver's door and performed another of my comical sliding exits.
"Be careful,"
she said anxiously, walking beside me with her arm around my waist as I crutched carefully through the snow to the door.
"Remember your leg."
"Yes, mother," I said, grinning a little. I stood in profile to the door when I got there, so I could bend down to the right and keep my weight off my bad leg. Bent over in the snow, left leg in the air, left hand holding onto my crutches, right hand grasping the roll-up door's handle. I must have looked like a circus contortionist. I pulled and felt the door give a little, but not quite enough. She was right. It had iced up pretty good along the bottom. You could hear it crackling. "Grab on and help me," I said. Lee placed both of her hands over my right hand, and we pulled together. That crackling sound became a little louder, but still the ice wouldn't quite give up its grip on the foot of the door. "We've almost got it," I said. My right leg was throbbing unpleasantly, and sweat was running down my cheeks. "I'll count. On three, give it all you got, okay?"
"Yes," she said.
"One, two, three!" What happened was the door came free of the ice all at once, with absurd, deadly ease. It flew upward on its tracks, and I stumbled backward, my crutches flying. My left leg folded underneath me, and I landed on it. The deep snow cushioned the fall somewhat, but I still felt the pain in a kind of silver bolt that seemed to ram upward from my thigh all the way to my temples and back down again. I clenched my teeth over a scream, barely keeping it in, and then Lee was on her knees in the snow beside me, her arm around my shoulders.
"Dennis, are you all right?"
"Help me up."
She had to do most of the pulling, and both of us were gasping like winded runners by the time I was on my feet again, with my crutches propped under me. Now I really needed them. My left leg was in agony.
"Dennis, you won't be able to work the clutch in that truck now."
"Yeah, I will. Help me back, Lee."
"You're as white as a ghost. I think we ought to get you to a doctor."
"No, help me back."
"Dennis,
Lee, help me back."
We inched our way back to Petunia through the snow, leaving shuffling, troubled tracks in the snow behind us. I reached up, laid hold of the steering wheel, and did a chin-up to get in, scraping feebly at the running board with my right leg. And still in the end, Lee had to get behind me and put both hands on my keister and shove. At last, I was behind Petunia's wheel, hot and shivering with pain. My shirt was wet with snowmelt and sweat. Until that day in January of 1979, I don't think I knew how much pain can make you sweat. I tried to jam down the clutch with my left foot, and that silver bolt of pain came again, making me throw my head back and grind my teeth until it subsided a little.
"Dennis, I'm going down the street and find a phone and call a doctor."
Her face was white and scared.
"You broke it again, didn't you? When you fell."
"I don't know," I said,
"but you can't do that, Lee.
It'll be your folks or mine if we don't end it now. You know that. LeBay won't stop. He has a well-developed sense of vengeance. We can't stop."
"But you can't drive it," she wailed.
She looked up into the cab at me, crying now. The hood of her parka had fallen back in our mutual struggle to get me up into the driver's seat, where I now sat in magnificent uselessness. I could see a scatter of snowflakes in her dark blonde hair.
"Go inside there," I said. "See if you can find a broom or a long stick of wood."
"What good will that do?"
she asked, crying harder.
"Just get it and then we'll see."
She went into the dark maw of the open door and disappeared from view. I held onto my leg and sparred with terror. If I really had broken my leg again, there was a good chance I'd be wearing a built-up heel on my left foot for the rest of my life. But there might not even be that much of my life left if we couldn't put a stop to Christine. Now there was a cheery thought. Lee came back with a push broom.
Will this do? She asked.
To get us inside, yes, then we'll see if we can find something better. The handle was the type that unscrews. I got hold of it, unthreaded it, and tossed the bristle end aside. Holding it in my left hand along my side, just another goddamn crutch, I pushed down the clutch with it. It held for a moment, then slipped off. The clutch sprang back up. The top of the handle almost bashed me in the mouth. Looking good, Gilder, but it would have to do. Come on, get in, I said.
Dennis, are you sure?
As sure as I can be, I said. She looked at me for a moment and then nodded.
Okay.
She went around to the passenger side and got in. I slammed my own door, depressed Petunia's clutch with the broom handle, and geared into first. I had the clutch halfway out and Petunia was just starting to roll forward when the broom handle slipped off the clutch again. The septic tanker ran inside Darnell's garage with a series of neck-snapping jerks, and when I slammed my right foot down on the brake, the truck stalled. We were mostly inside. Lee, I've got to have something with a wider foot, I said. This broom handle don't cut it.
I'll see what there is.
She got out and began to walk around the edge of the garage floor, hunting. I stared around. Creepy, Lee had said, and she was right. The only cars left were four or five old soldiers, so gravely wounded that no one had cared enough to claim them. All the rest of the slant spaces, with their numbers stenciled in white paint, were empty. I glanced at stall 20, and then glanced away. The overhead tire racks were likewise nearly empty. A few baldies remained, heeled over against one another like giant donuts blackened in a fire, but that was all. One of the two lifts was partially up, with a wheel rim caught beneath it. The front-end alignment chart on the right-hand wall glimmered faintly red and white, the two headlight targets like bloodshot eyes, and shadows. Shadows everywhere. Overhead, big box-shaped heaters pointed their louvers this way and that, roosting up there like weird bats. It seemed very much like a death place. Lee had used another of Jimmy's keys to open Will's office. I could see her moving back and forth in there through the window Will had used to look out at his customers. Those working Joes who had to keep their cars running so they could blah, blah, blah. She flipped some switches, and the overhead fluorescence came on in snow-cold ranks. So the electric company hadn't cut off the juice. I'd have to have her turn the lights off again. We couldn't afford to risk attracting attention, but at least we could have some heat. She opened another door and disappeared temporarily from view. I glanced at my watch. 1:30 now. She came back and I saw that she was holding an O-cedar mop, the kind with the wide yellow sponge along the foot.
Would this be any good?
Only perfect, I said. Get in, kiddo, we're in business. She climbed up once more and I pushed the clutch down with the mop. Lots better, I said. Where did you find it?
In the bathroom,
she said. And wrinkled her nose. Bad in there?
Dirty, reeking of cigars, and there's a whole pile of moldy books in the corner, the kind they sell at those little hole-in-the-wall stores.
So that was what Darnell left behind him, I thought. An empty garage, a pile of beeline books, and a phantom reek of Roy Tan cigars. I felt cold again, and thought that if I had my way, I'd see this place bulldozed flat and pasted over with hot top. I could not shake the feeling that it was an unmarked grave of a sort, the place where LeBay and Christine had killed my friend's mind and taken over his life.
I can't wait to get out of here, Lee said, looking around nervously.
Really? I kind of like it. I was thinking of moving in. I caressed her shoulder and looked deeply into her eyes.
We could start a family,
I breathed.
She held up a fist. Want me to start a nosebleed?
Nah, that's all right. For what it's worth, I can't wait to get out of here either. I drove Petunia the rest of the way inside. I found that I could run the clutch pretty well using the O-cedar mop, in first gear at least. The handle had a tendency to bend, and I would have preferred something thicker, but it would have to do unless we could find something better in the meantime. We've got to turn off the lights again, I said, killing the engine. The wrong people might see them. She got out and turned them off while I swung Petunia in a wide circle and then carefully backed it up until the rear end almost touched the window between the garage and Darnell's office. Now the big truck's snout was pointing directly back at the open overhead door through which we had entered. With the lights off, the shadows descended again. The light coming in through the open door was weak, muted by the snow, white and without strength. It spread on the oil-stained, cracked concrete like a pie wedge and simply died halfway across the floor.
"I'm cold, Dennis," Lee called from Darnell's office. "He's got the switches for the heat marked. Can I turn them on?"
"Go ahead," I called back. A moment later, the garage whispered with the sound of the blowers. I leaned back against the seat, gently running my hands over my left leg. The material of my jeans was stretched smoothly over the thigh, tight and without a wrinkle. The son of a bitch was swelling. And it hurt. Christ, did it hurt. Lee came back and climbed up beside me. She told me again how terrible I looked, and for some reason my mind cross-patched, and I thought of the afternoon Arnie had brought Christine down here, of the bebop queen's husband yelling for Arnie to get that hunk of junk out from in front of his house, and of Arnie telling me the guy was a regular Robert Deadford, how we'd gotten the giggles. I closed my eyes against the sting of tears. With nothing to do but wait, time slowed down. It was 1:45, then 2:00. Outside, the snow had thickened a little, but not much. Lee got out of the truck and pushed the button that trundled the door back down. That made it even darker inside. She came back, climbed up, and said, "There's a funny gadget on the side of the door. See it? It looks just like the electronic garage door opener we used to have when we lived in Weston." I sat up suddenly, stared at it. "Oh," I said, "oh, Jesus.
What's the matter?"
"That's just what it is, a garage door opener. And there's one of the transmitter gadgets on Christine. Arnie mentioned that to me Thanksgiving night. You've got to break it, Lee. Use the handle of that push broom." She got down again, picked up the broom handle, and stood below the electric eye gadget, looking up and bashing at it with the handle. She looked like a woman trying to kill a bug near the ceiling. At last, she was rewarded with a crunch of plastic and tinkle of glass. She came back slowly, tossing the broom handle aside, and got up beside me.
"Dennis, don't you think it's time you told me exactly what you've got in mind?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know what I mean," she said, and pointed at the closed overhead door. 5 square windows in a line 3/4 of the way up its height let in minimal light through dirty glass. "When it gets dark, you plan to open that door again, don't you?"
I nodded. The door itself was wood, but it was braced with hinged steel strips, like the inner gate of an old-time elevator. I'd let her in, but once that door was shut, Christine wouldn't be able to bash her way back out again. I hoped. It made me cold to think how close we'd come to overlooking the electronic door opener. Open the door at dusk. Yes. Let Christine in. Yes. Close the door again. Then I would use Petunia to batter her to death.
"Okay," she said. "That's the trap. But once she... it comes in, how are you going to get that door shut again to keep her in? Maybe there's a button in Darnell's office that does it, but I didn't see it."
"So far as I know, there isn't one," I said. "So you're going to be standing over there by the button that shuts the door." I pointed. The manual button was located on the right side of the door, about 2 feet below the ruins of the electric door opener box. "You'll be against the wall, out of sight. When Christine comes in, always assuming she does, you're going to push the button that starts the door coming down, and then step outside in a hurry. The door comes down, and bam, the trap shut." Her face set.
"On you as well as her. In the words of the immortal Wordsworth, that sucks."
"That's Coleridge, not Wordsworth. There's no other way to do it, Lee. If you're still inside when that door comes down, Christine is going to run you down. Even if there was a button in Darnell's office, well, you saw in the paper what happened to the side of his house." Her face was stubborn.
"Park over by the switch, and when she comes in, I'll reach out the window and hit the button and lower the door."
If I park there, I'll be in sight, and if this tank is in sight, she won't come in.
I don't like it, she burst out. I don't like leaving you alone. It's like you tricked me.
In a way, that's just what I had done. And for whatever it's worth, I would not do it the same way now. But I was going on 18 then, and there's no male chauvinist pig like an 18-year-old male chauvinist pig. I put an arm around her shoulders. She resisted stiffly for a moment, and then came to me. There's just no other way, I said. If it wasn't for my leg, or if you could drive a standard shift. I shrugged.
I'm scared for you, Dennis. I want to help.
You'll be helping plenty. You're the one that's really in danger, Lee. You'll be outside, on the floor, when she comes in. I'm just going to sit up here in the cab and beat that bitch back into component parts.
I only hope it works that way, she said, and put her head on my chest. I touched her hair.
So we waited. In my mind's eye, I could see Arnie coming out of the main building at LHS, books under his arm. I could see Regina waiting for him there in the Cunningham's compact wagon, radiant with happiness. Arnie smiling remotely and submitting to her embrace.
Arnie, you've made the right decision. You don't know how relieved, how happy your father and I are.
Yes, Mom.
Do you want to drive, honey?
No, you drive, Mom. That's okay. The two of them setting off for Penn State through the light snow. Regina driving, Arnie sitting in the shotgun seat with his hands folded stiffly in his lap, his face pale and unsmiling and clear of acne. And back in the student parking lot at LHS, Christine sitting silently in the driveway, waiting for the snow to thicken, waiting for dark. At 3:30 or so, Lee went back through Darnell's office to use the bathroom, and while she was gone, I dry-swallowed two more Darvon. My leg was a steady, leaden agony. Shortly after that, I lost coherent track of time. The dope had me fuddled, I guess. The whole thing began to seem dreamlike. The deepening shadows, the white light coming in through the windows slowly changing to an ashy gray, the drone of the overhead heaters. I think that Lee and I made love, not in the ordinary way, not with my leg the way it was, but some kind of sweet substitute. I seem to remember her breath steepening in my ear until she was nearly panting. I seem to remember her whispering for me to be careful, to please be careful, that she had lost Arnie and could not bear to lose me, too. I seem to remember an explosion of pleasure that made the pain disappear in a brief but total way that not all the Darvon in the world could manage. But brief was the right word. It was all too brief. And then, I think, I dozed. The next thing I remember for sure was Lee shaking me fully awake and whispering my name over and over in my ear.
What?
I was spaced out, and my leg was full of a glassy pain, simply waiting to explode. There was an ache in my temples, and my eyes felt too big for their sockets. I blinked around at Lee like a large, stupid owl.
It's dark, she said. I thought I heard something.
I blinked again and saw that she looked drawn and frightened. Then I glanced toward the door and saw that it was standing open.
How the hell did that... Me, she said. I opened it.
Cripes, I said, straightening up a little and wincing at the pain in my leg.
That wasn't too smart, Lee. If she had come...
She didn't, Lee said.
It started to get dark, that's all, and to snow harder. So I got out and opened the door, and then I came back here. I kept thinking you'd wake up in a minute. You were mumbling, and I kept thinking, I'll wait until it's really dark. I'll just wait until it's really dark. And then I saw I was fooling myself, because it's been dark for almost half an hour now, and I was only thinking I could still see some light, because I wanted to see it, I guess. And just now, I thought I heard something.
Her lips began to tremble, and she pressed them tightly together. I looked at my watch and saw that it was 5:45. If everything had gone right, my parents and sister would be together with Michael and Lee's folks now. I looked through Petunia's windshield at the square of snow-shot darkness where the garage entrance was. I could hear the wind shrieking. A thin creeper of snow had already blown in onto the cement.
You just heard the wind, I said uneasily. It's walking and talking out there.
Maybe, but...
I nodded reluctantly. I didn't want her to leave the safety of Petunia's high cab. But if she didn't go now, maybe she never would. I wouldn't let her, and she would let me not let her. And then, when and if Christine came, all she would have to do would be to reverse back out of Darnell's. And wait for a more opportune time. Okay, I said. But remember, stand back in that little niche to the right of the door. If she comes, she may just stand outside for a while. Scenting the air like an animal, I thought. Don't get scared. Don't move. Don't let her freak you into giving yourself away. Just be cool and wait until she comes in. Then push that button and get the hell out. Do you understand?
Yes, she whispered. Dennis, will this work?
It should, if she comes at all.
I won't see you until it's over.
I guess that's so. She leaned over, placed her left hand lightly on the side of my neck, and kissed my mouth.
Be careful, Dennis,
she said.
But kill it. It's really not a she at all, just an it. Kill it.
I will, I said. She looked in my eyes and nodded.
Do it for Arnie, she said. Set him free.
I hugged her hard, and she hugged me back. Then she slid across the seat. She hit her little handbag with her knee, and it fell to the floor of the cab. She paused, head cocked, a startled, thoughtful look in her eyes. Then she smiled, bent over, picked it up, and began to rummage quickly through it.
Dennis, she said, do you remember the Mort d'Arthur?
A little. One of the classes Lee and Arnie and I had all shared before my football injury was Fudgy Bowen's Classics of English Literature, and one of the first things we had been faced with in there was Malory's Mort d'Arthur. Why Lee asked me this now was a mystery to me. She had found what she wanted. It was a filmy pink scarf, nylon, the sort of thing a girl wears over her head on a day when a misty sort of rain is falling. She tied it around the left forearm of my parka. What the hell? I asked, smiling a little.
Be my knight, she said,
and smiled back. But her eyes were serious.
Be my knight, Dennis.
I picked up the squeegee mop she had found in Will's bathroom and made a clumsy salute with it. Sure, I said. Just call me Sir O'Cedar.
Joke about it if you want, she said. But don't really joke about it, okay?
All right. I said. If it's what you want, I'll be your perfect goddamn gentle knight. She laughed a little, and that was better. Remember about that button, kiddo. Push it hard. We don't want that door to just burp once and stop on its track. No escapes, right?
Right.
She got out of Petunia, and I can close my eyes now and see her as she was then, in that clean and silent moment, just before everything went terribly wrong. A tall, pretty girl with long blonde hair the color of raw honey, slim hips, long legs, and those striking Nordic cheekbones, now wearing a ski parka and faded Lee Riders, moving with a dancer's grace. I can still see it, and I still dream about it, because, of course, while we were busy setting up Christine, she was busy setting us up. That old and infinitely wise monster. Did we really think we could outsmart her so easily? I guess we did. My dreams are in terrible slow motion. I can see the softly lovely motion of her hips as she walks. I can hear the hollow click of her fry boots on the oil-stained cement floor. I can even hear the soft, dry whish-whish of her parka's quilted inner lining brushing against her blouse. She's walking slowly, and her head is up. Now she is the animal, but no predator. She walks with the cautious grace of a zebra approaching a waterhole at dusk. It is the walk of an animal that scents danger. I try to scream to her through Petunia's windshield. Come back, Lee! Come back quick! You were right! You heard something! She's out there now! Out there in the snow with her headlights off! Crouch down! Lee, come back! She stopped suddenly, her hands tensing into fists. And that was when sudden, savage circles of light sprang to life in the snowy dark outside. They were like white eyes opening. Lee froze, hideously exposed on the open floor. She was 30 feet inside the door and slightly to the right of center. She turned toward the headlights, and I could see the dazed, uncertain expression on her face. I was just as stunned, and that first vital moment passed unused. Then the headlights sprang forward, and I could see the dark, low-slung shape of Christine behind them. I could hear the mounting, furious howl of her engine as she leaped toward us from across the street where she had been waiting all along, maybe even since before dark. Snow funneled back from her roof and skirled across her windshield in filmy nets that were almost instantly melted by the defroster. She hit the tarmac leading up to the entrance, still gaining speed. Her engine was a V8 scream of rage. "Lee!" I screamed and clawed for Petunia's ignition switch. Lee broke to the right and ran for the wall button. Christine roared inside as she reached it and pushed it. I heard the rattle rumble of the overhead door descending on its track. Christine came in angling to the right, going for Lee. She dug a great clout of dry wood and splinters from the wall. There was a metallic screech as part of her right bumper pulled loose, a sound like a drunk scream of laughter. Sparks cascaded across the floor as she went into a long, slewing turn. She missed Lee, but she wouldn't when she went back. Lee was stuck in that right-hand corner with nowhere to hide. She might be able to make it outside, but I was terribly afraid that the door wasn't coming down fast enough to cut off Christine. The descending door might peel off her roof, but that wouldn't stop her, and I knew it. Petunia's engine bellowed, and I dragged out the headlight button. Her brights came on, splashing over the closing door and over Lee. She was backed up against the wall, her eyes wide. Her parka took on a weird, almost electric blue color in the headlights, and my mind informed me with sickening and clinical accuracy that her blood would look purple. I saw her glance upward for a moment and then back down at Christine. The Fury's tires screamed violently as she leaped at Lee. Smoke rose from the new black marks on the concrete. I just had time to register the fact that there were people inside of Christine, a whole carload of them. At the same instant that Christine roared toward her, Lee leaped upward with a big, ungainly jack-in-the-box spring. My mind, seeming to run at a speed approaching light, wondered for a moment if she was intending to leap right over the Plymouth, as if instead of fries, she wore boots of the Seven League variety. Instead, she caught and gripped the rusted metal struts, which supported an overhead shelf almost 9 feet above the floor, over 3 feet above her head. This shelf skirted all four walls. On the night Arnie and I had first brought Christine in, that entire shelf had been crammed with recapped tires and old baldies waiting to be recapped. In some funny way, it had reminded me of a well-stocked library shelf. Now, it was mostly empty. Holding those angled struts, Lee swung her jeaned legs up like a kid who meant to throw his legs right over his own shoulders, what we used to call skinning the cat in grammar school. Christine's snout smashed into the wall directly below her. If she had been any slower getting her legs up, they would have been mashed off at the knees. A piece of chrome flew. Two of the remaining tires tumbled from the shelf and bounced crazily on the cement like giant rubber donuts. Lee's head smashed back against the wall with battering, dazing force as Christine reversed, all four of her tires laying rubber and squirting blue smoke. And what was I doing all this time, you wonder? It wasn't all that time. That is my answer. Even as I used the O-Cedar mop to depress Petunia's clutch and gear into first, the overhead door was just thumping down. All of it had happened in the space of seconds. Lee was still holding on to the struts supporting the tire shelf, but now she only hung there, head down, dazed. I let the clutch out, and a cold part of my mind took over. Easy, man. If you pop the clutch and stall this fucker, she's dead. Petunia rolled. I revved the engine up to a bellow and let the clutch out all the way. Christine roared at her hood crimped almost double from her first hit, bright metal showing through the broken paint at the sharpest points of bend. It looked as if her hood and grill had grown shark's teeth. I hit Christine 3/4 of the way toward the front, and she slid around, one of her tires pulling off the rim. The 58 slammed into a litter of old bumper jacks and junk parts in one corner. There was a booming crash as she struck the wall, and then the hot sound of her engine, revving and falling off, revving and falling off. The entire left front end was bashed in, but she was still running. I slammed on Petunia's brake with my right foot and barely managed to avoid crushing Lee myself. Petunia's engine stalled. Now the only sound in the garage was Christine's screaming engine. "Lee!" I screamed over it. "Lee, run!" She looked over at me groggily, and now I could see sticky braids of blood in her hair. It was as purple as I had expected. She let go of the struts, landed on her feet, staggered, and went to one knee. Christine came for her. Lee got up, took two wobbling steps, and got on her blind side, behind Petunia. Christine swerved and struck the truck's front end. I was thrown roughly to the right. Pain roared through my left leg. "Get up!" I screamed at Lee, trying to lean even farther over and open the door. "Get up!" Christine backed off, and when she came again, she cut hard to the right and went out of my line of vision, around the back of Petunia. I caught just a glimpse of her in the rearview mirror, bolted outside the driver's side window. Then I could only hear the scream of her tires. Barely conscious, Lee simply wandered off, holding both hands laced to the back of her head. Blood trickled through her fingers. She walked in front of Petunia's grill toward me, and then just stopped. I didn't have to see in order to know what was going to happen next. Christine would reverse again, back to my side, and then crush her against the wall. Desperately, I shoved the clutch in with the mop and keyed the engine again. It turned over, coughed, stalled. I could smell gasoline in the air, heavy and rich. I had flooded the engine. Christine reappeared in the rearview mirror. She came at Lee, who managed to stumble backward just out of reach. Christine slammed nose-on into the wall with crunching force. The passenger door popped open, and the horror was complete. The hand not clutching the mop handle went to my mouth, and I screamed through it. Sitting on the passenger's side, like a grotesque, life-size doll, was Michael Cunningham. His head, lolling limply on the stalk of his neck, snapped over to one side as Christine reversed to make another try at Lee, and I saw his face had the high, rosy color of carbon monoxide poisoning. He hadn't taken my advice. Christine had gone to the Cunninghams' house first, as I had vaguely suspected she might. Michael came home from school, and there she was, standing in the driveway, his son's restored 1958 Plymouth. He had gone to it, and somehow Christine had gotten him. Had he maybe gotten in just to sit behind the wheel for a moment, as I had that day in LeBay's garage? Just to see what vibrations he could pick up. If so, he must have picked up some terrible vibes indeed during his last few minutes on Earth. Had Christine started herself up, driven herself into the garage? Maybe. Maybe. And had Michael discovered that he could neither turn off the madly revving engine nor get out of the car? Had he maybe turned his head and perhaps seen the true guiding spirit of Arnie's 58 Fury lounging in the shotgun seat and fainted in terror? It didn't matter now. Lee was all that mattered. She had seen, too. Her screams, high, despairing and shrill, floated in the exhaust-stinking air like hysterically bright balloons. But it had, at least, cut through her days. She turned and ran for Will Darnell's office, blood spattering behind her in dime-sized drops as she went. Blood was soaking into the collar of her parka. Too much blood. Christine backed up, laying rubber and leaving a scatter of glass behind. As she pulled around in a tight circle to go after Lee, centrifugal force pulled the passenger door shut again, but not before I saw Michael's head loll back the other way. Christine held still for a moment, her nose pointed toward Lee, her engine revving. Perhaps LeBay was savoring the instant before the kill. If so, I'm glad, because if Christine had gone for her right away, she would have been killed then. But as it was, I had an instant of time I turned the key again, babbling something aloud, a prayer, I guess, and this time Petunia's engine coughed into life. I let the clutch out and stepped down on the accelerator as Christine leaped forward again. This time, I struck her right side. There was a shrill scream of tearing metal as Petunia's bumper punched through her mudguard. Christine heeled over and smashed against the wall. Glass broke. Her engine raced and raved. Behind the wheel, LeBay turned toward me, grinning with hate. Petunia stalled again. I rattled off a string of every curse I knew as I grabbed for the key again. If not for my goddamn leg, if not for the fall I'd taken in the snow, this would be over now. It would be just a matter of cornering her and smashing her to pieces against the cinder block. But even as I cranked Petunia's engine, keeping my foot off the gas to keep from stalling her again, Christine began to reverse with an ear-splitting squeal of metal. She backed out from between Petunia's grill and the wall, leaving a twisted chunk of her red body behind, bearing her right front tire. I got Petunia going and found reverse. Christine had backed all the way to the far end of the garage. All her headlights were out. Her windshield was smashed into a galaxy of cracks. The bent hood seemed to sneer. Her radio was blasting. I could hear Ricky Nelson singing, "Waiting in School." I stared around for Lee and saw her in Will's office, looking out into the garage. Her blonde hair was matted with blood. More blood ran down the left side of her face and soaked into her jacket. Bleeding too damn much, I thought incoherently. Bleeding too damn much, even for a head wound. Her eyes widened and she pointed past me, her lips moving soundlessly behind the glass. Christine came roaring straight up the empty floor, gaining speed. And the hood was uncrimping, straightening out and down to cover the motor cavity again. Two of the headlights flickered, then came back strong. The mudguard and the right-hand side of her body, I only caught a glimpse, but I swear it's true, they were re-knitting themselves, red metal appearing from nowhere and slipping down in smooth automotive curves to cover the right front tire and the right side of the engine compartment again. The cracks in the windshield were running inward and disappearing, and the tire that had been pulled off its rim looked as good as new. "It all looks as good as new," I thought. "God help us." She was going directly for the wall between the garage and the office. I let the mop handle off the clutch fast, hoping to interpose the tanker's body, but Christine got past me. Petunia backed into nothing but thin air. Oh, I was doing great. I backed all the way across the floor and crashed into the dented tool lockers ranged there. They crashed to the floor with dull metallic janglings. Through the windshield, I saw Christine hit the wall between the garage and Will's office. She never slowed. She went full speed ahead. I'll never forget those next few moments. They remain hypnotically clear in my memory, as if through a magnifying crystal. Lee saw Christine coming and stumbled backward. Her bloody hair was matted to her head. She fell over Will's swivel chair. She hit the floor, out of sight behind his desk. An instant later, and I mean the barest instant, Christine slammed into the wall. The big window Will had used to keep track of the comings and goings out in his garage exploded inward. Glass flew like a cluster of deadly spears. Christine's front end bulged with the impact. The hood popped up and then tore off, flying back over the roof to land on the concrete with a metallic sound that was much like the sound the falling tool lockers had made. Her windshield shattered, and Michael Cunningham's body flew through the jagged opening, legs trailing, his head a grotesque, flattened football. He was catapulted through Will's window. He struck Will's desk with a heavy grain sack thud and skidded over onto the floor. His shoes stuck up. Lee began to scream. Her fall had probably saved her from being badly lacerated or killed by the flying glass. But when she rose from behind the desk, her face was contorted with horror, and utter hysteria had its hold on her. Michael had skidded from the desk, and his arms had looped themselves over her shoulders, and as Lee struggled to her feet, she appeared to be waltzing with the corpse. Her screams were like fire bells. Her blood, still flowing, sparkled deadly bright. She dumped Michael and ran for the door. "Lee, no!" I screamed, and slammed down the clutch with the mop again. The handle snapped cleanly in two, leaving me with a stump 5 inches long. "Oh, shit!" Christine reversed away from the broken window, leaving water, antifreeze, and oil puddled on the floor. I stamped down on the clutch with my left foot, barely feeling the pain now, bracing my left knee with my left hand as I worked the gear shift. Lee tore the office door open and ran out. Christine turned toward her, its smashed, snarling snout sighting down on her. I revved Petunia's engine and roared at her, and as that damned car from hell grew in the windshield, I saw the purple, swollen face of a child pressed to the rear window, watching me, seeming to beg me to stop. I struck her hard. The trunk lid popped up and gaped like a mouth. The rear end heeled around, and Christine went skidding sideways past Lee, who fled with her eyes seeming to swallow her face. I remember the spray of blood along the fur fringe of her parka's hood, tiny droplets like an evil fall of dew. I was in it now. I was in the peak seat. Even if they had to take my leg off at the groin when this was done, I was going to drive. Christine hit the wall and bounced back. I stamped the clutch, rammed the gear shift into reverse, backed up 10 feet, stamped the clutch again, rammed it back into first. Engine revving, Christine tried to pull away along the wall. I cut to the left and hit her again, crushing her almost wasp-waisted in the middle. The doors popped out of their frames at the top and at the bottom. LeBay was behind the wheel, now a skull, now a decayed and stinking cameo of humanity, now a hale and hearty man in his 50s with a crew cut turning white. He stared out at me with his devil's grin, one hand on the wheel, one balled into a fist that he shook at me. And still her engine would not die. I got into reverse again, and now my leg was white iron, and the pain was all the way up to my left armpit. The hell it was, the pain was everywhere. I could feel it. Michael, Jesus, why didn't you stay in the house? In my neck, in my jaw, in my... Arnie, man, I am so sorry. I wish... Temples, the Plymouth, what remained of her, lunged drunkenly down the side of the garage, spraying tools and junk metal, pulling out struts and dumping the overhead shelves. The shelves hit the concrete with flat clapping sounds that echoed like demon applause. I stamped the clutch again and floored the gas. Petunia's engine bellowed, and I hung onto the wheel like a man trying to stay aboard a bucking Mustang. I hit her on the right side and smashed the body clear off the rear axle, driving it into the door, which shivered and rattled. I went up over the wheel, which slammed into my belly and drove the breath out of me and dumped me back into my seat, gasping. Now I saw Lee, cowering in the far corner, her hands clapped to her face, dragging it down into a witch's mask. Christine's engine was still running. She dragged herself slowly down toward Lee, like an animal whose rear legs had been broken in a trap. And even as she went, I could see her regenerating, coming back, a tire that suddenly popped up full and plump, the radio antenna that unjointed itself with a silvery twing sound, the accretion of metal around the ruined rear end. "Stay dead!" I screamed at it. I was crying, my chest heaving. My leg wouldn't work anymore. I braced it with both hands and jammed it onto the clutch. My vision went hazy and gray with the white metal agony. I could almost feel the bones grating. I raced the engine, got first gear again, and charged it. And as I did, I heard LeBay's voice for the first and only time, high and cheated and full of a terrible, unquenchable fury. "You shitter! Fuck off, you miserable shitter! Leave me alone!" "You shoulda left my friend alone," I tried to yell, but all that would come out was a tearing, wounded gasp. I hit it squarely in the rear end, and the gas tank ruptured as the back of the car accordioned inward and upward in a kind of metal mushroom. There was a yellow lick of fire. I shielded my face with my hands, but then it was gone. Christine sat there, a refugee from a demolition derby. Her engine ran choppily, missed, fired again, and then died. The place was silent, except for the bass rumble of Petunia's engine. Then Lee was running across the floor, screaming my name over and over, crying. I was suddenly stupidly aware that I was wearing her pink nylon scarf around the arm of my jacket. I looked down at it, and then the world grayed out again. I could feel her hands on me, and then there was nothing but darkness, as I fainted. I came to about 15 minutes later, my face wet and blessedly cool. Lee was standing on Petunia's driver's side running board, mopping my face with a wet rag. I caught it in one hand, tried to suck it, and then spat. The rag tasted strongly of oil.
"Dennis, don't worry," she said. "I ran out into the street, stopped a snowplow, scared the poor man out of 10 years of his life, I think, on his blood. He said, an ambulance, he said he'd, you know, Dennis, are you all right?"
"Do I look all right?" I whispered.
"No,"
she said, and burst into tears. "Then don't," I swallowed past a painful, dry lump in my throat. "Don't ask stupid questions. I love you." She hugged me clumsily.
"He said he'd call the police, too," she said.
I barely heard her. My eyes had found the twisted, silent hulk that was Christine's remains. And hulk was the right word. She hardly looked like a car at all anymore. But why hadn't she burned? A hubcap lay off to one side like a dented silver tiddlywink. "How long since you stopped the plow?" I asked hoarsely.
"Maybe 5 minutes. Then I got the rag and dipped it in that bucket over there. Dennis, thank God it's over."
Punk, punk, punk. I was still looking at the hubcap. The dents were popping out of it. Abruptly, it flicked up on its rim and rolled toward the car like a huge coin. Lee saw it, too. Her face froze. Her eyes widened and began to bulge. Her lips mouthed the word no, but no sound came out. "Get in here with me," I said in a low voice, as if it could hear us. How do I know? Perhaps it could. "Get in on the passenger side. You're going to run the gas while I run the clutch with my right foot."
"No!"
This time it was a hissing whisper. Her breath came in whining little gasps.
"No! No!"
The wreckage was quivering all over. It was the most eerie, most terrible thing I have ever seen in my life. It was quivering all over, quivering like an animal that is not quite dead. Metal tapped nervously against metal. Tie rods clicked jittery jazz rhythms against their connectors. As I watched, a bent cotter pin lying on the floor straightened itself and did half a dozen cartwheels to land in the wreckage. "Get in," I said.
"Dennis, I can't."
Her lips quivered helplessly.
"I can't. No more. That body. That was Arnie's father. I can't no more, please."
"You have to," I said. She looked at me, glanced affrightedly back at the obscenely quivering remains of that old whore LeBay and Arnie had shared, and then came around Petunia's front end. A piece of chrome tumbled and scratched her leg deeply. She screamed and ran. She clambered up into the cab and pushed over beside me.
What do I do?"
I hung halfway out of the cab, holding on to the roof, and pushed the clutch down with my right foot. Petunia's engine was still running. "Just gun the gas and keep it gunned," I said, "no matter what." Steering with my right hand, holding on with my left, I let the clutch out, and we rolled forward and smashed into the wreckage, smashing it, scattering it, and in my head, I seemed to hear another scream of fury. Lee clapped her hands to her head.
"I can't, Dennis. I can't do it. It's screaming."
"You've got to do it," I said. Her foot had come off the gas, and now I could hear sirens in the night, rising and falling. I grabbed her shoulder, and a sickening blast of pain ripped up my leg. "Lee, nothing has changed. You've got to."
"It screamed at me."
"We're running out of time, and it still isn't done. Just a little more."
"I'll try,"
she whispered, and stepped on the gas again. I shifted into reverse. Petunia rolled back 20 feet. I clutched again, got first, and Lee suddenly cried out,
"Dennis, no, don't, look!"
The mother and the little girl, Veronica and Rita, were standing in front of the smashed and dented hulk of Christine, hand in hand, their faces solemn and sorrowing.
"They're not there," I said, "and if they are, it's time they went back."
More pain in my leg, and the world went gray.
"Back to where they belong. Keep your foot on it."
I let out the clutch, and Petunia rolled forward again, gaining speed. The two figures did not disappear as TV and movie ghosts do. They seemed to stream out in every direction, bright colors fading to wash pinks and blues. And then, they were totally gone. We slammed into Christine again, spinning what was left of her around. Metal shrieked and tore.
"Not there," Lee whispered. "Not really there. Okay. Okay, Dennis."
Her voice was coming from far down a dark hallway. I fetched up reverse, and back we went. Then forward. We hit it. We